Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Rates and Barrels. It is Thursday, March 28th. Happy opening day. It is the real opening day.
Yeah, yes, thumbs up.
Got the thumbs up right away. We're off to a fantastic start. All 30 teams were supposed to be in action today. We learned on Wednesday that a couple of games were going to be postponed to Friday because of weather. So no Brewers Mets, no Phillies Braves, at least for today. So hopefully we'll see more teams in action on Friday as a result. But anyway, we made it barely after dozens of drafts combined between the two of us and live shows and team previews and position previews. Like, it's here. It finally begins.
I know. New data.
New numbers.
Talking about that. The same numbers for like months.
No.
I like baseball. It's just not about numbers.
No, it's just, yes, we've been pouring over
but
the same
figures.
But
we've been immersed in baseball.
For 6 months.
You know, in fact, right now, I'm pretty sure my UCL hurts from two things. Throwing batting practice a lot, and two, holding my phone to look at baseball-type stuff and Twitter-type stuff while at baseball games. So.
You should use your non-throwing arm for that, given the extra strain on your throwing arm.
Then I don't think my thumb is as dexterous on that side or something.
No,
and the phones now are so big. Like, I don't
get one of those Velcro straps. Just strap the phone to your other hand if your hand can't handle it.
That'll look good.
You're in dad mode anyway, so what's the difference? Yeah,
that's right. What I care about looking good.
I've given up completely. Like, you're gonna see decay in me that you never thought was possible.
Like a little a left forearm strap for my phone that just holds it there so I can
Yeah, and if you drop it, it just dangles down next to your elbow, but it doesn't fall and break on the ground. It seems like a pretty good little invention.
Oh, my God. I mean, hey, I never thought that fanny packs would come back. So I thought, growing up, fanny packs were that is the dorkiest thing I've ever seen.
Are they back? I mean, a lot of 90s stuff came back, so that makes sense.
Well, my wife is wearing them again, at least.
Well, they're very practical if you have to hold a lot of things and don't want something, over your arm or on your back. So
or tons of stuff in your pockets.
Yeah. Yeah, that too. Unless you want to wear cargo. See, cargo is going to come back next. The fanny packs will come out and all your cargo pants and cargo shorts are going
to
follow.
Cargo and strap my phone to my wrist. Here we go.
Best thing about living the cycle once is that you know what's coming the second time around.
Oh, yeah. When I was choosing my shirt, I was like, flannel.
You're back in a grunge phase.
But it's fitted now because I'm an adult.
Right, it's not the size of a tent.
It's not the flannels I used to have. Well, I still have one of those.
All right.
Literally.
Well.
From seventh grade.
Nice job. Glad you made it all the way from seventh. That's a long shelf life for a shirt. That shirt will have been with you longer than Will Smith will be with the Dodgers, even with Will Smith signing a 10-year, $140 million extension. The numbers seemed a little weird. Like, the number of years seemed a little long. The number of dollars.
$30 million signing bonus.
Like, a little low, but it's all kind of just part of the Dodgers' unique financial structuring of all these deals. It keeps the average annual value down, which has luxury tax implications. Presumably, it keeps Will Smith in Dodger blue for the rest of his career. They could potentially trade him at some point, I guess. That's always a possibility, but it's interesting because I think we like him as maybe the best hitting catcher in the game right now. There are plenty of other contenders, and I wonder how well he's going to age. He's 29 years old today, so happy 29th birthday to Will Smith, who's never heard of Rates and Barrels and will probably never listen to it. But he looks like a player whose profile will age really well. It's sort of a question of what will they do with him defensively over a contract that long, because we rarely see deals this long anyway, and I don't think we ever see them for catchers. And you begin the deal this way, but where do you play after year 5 or year 6 when presumably someone much younger will be the starting catcher and maybe he's a part-time catcher and a part-time something else?
I mean, I think he has the bat to do it. I mean, that's the fun part about him, is that he's such a great defensive catcher. But, you know, with yearly 10% barrel rates and, you know, 16 to 18% strikeout rates and 11% walk rates, like, that would be a good DH. You know, might be a little bit less power than other DHs. But if he could play first, which I think he could probably hit that bump along the way, then I think he's got a lot of places he can play. One of the things that's also kind of amazing about this is that some of it's deferred. So what is the deal? Ken Rosenthal's story about this, where Teoscar Hernandez had deferred money, and of course we know all about Shohei Ohtani's deferred money. But there's deferred money also, $172 million of deferred money in Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman's deals. There's this great number in here in this piece. $870 million in deferred money. And I think this piece came out before the Will Smith one, where he's deferring like $5 million a year for a few years. So, I mean, you're talking about almost $900 million in deferred money that they'll owe from 2028 to 2040. Are they just going to sell the team?
Right, in like 2027 before they have to start paying the deferrals?
Yeah, like what we're seeing a little bit of the chickens coming home to roost in Washington, I feel like, because they did the same thing where they just hit a bunch of deferred money. There's a lot of reasons to do it. One person pointed out that they are owned by an investment group. And so the idea that money has present value and future value, and those are different. I think maybe the idea is that they think they can beat the market, right? And like use the money they have now to like make more money to pay those people later.
Yeah, I wonder what happens if they're wrong. We don't have to get into that right now, but what if it collapses? What if they're wrong?
I mean, what if the Ohtani story goes in a certain direction?
Yeah, a lot of what ifs, maybe for a different day.
Yeah. No, but I think Will Smith is worth this. And I think that extending him to 38 also helps him with the CBT and keeps that number down. And I would say this is team friendly.
Yeah, and I think the other way to look at it too is he's now signed, I think, for the same number of years as Ohtani. If Ohtani's not going to play the field, and he remains mostly a DH that whole time, then Will Smith would have to play first base or somewhere else defensively if he's not going to remain a catcher, because you have those two guys locked up for a very long time. Eventually, Freddie Freeman won't be a Dodger after 2027, so we're still 4 years away from that point. But other news to get to, some good news. Jordan Romano may only need a minimum stint on the IL. Things have been tracking this way since there was no structural damage detected when he had further testing done on his elbow. So if you're trying to invest in the Blue Jays bullpen in the short term, that's exactly what it is. It's probably just a week or two of trying to find saves as opposed to a month plus, which some people may have thought they were doing drafting over the last week or so.
Yeah, Jimmy Garcia might still be an interesting pickup long-term for saves and holds because Eric Swanson is out. But as I mentioned before, I like Chad Green there to possibly be the setup man as well. So I think they can hold fort for 2 weeks and they'll be all right, you know, in terms of thinking about the Blue Jays as a whole. And then in terms of playing, if you took Romano, just don't drop him, I think. Just hold for a little bit. At least get some more news.
Pretty easy hold at this point, given it's a shorter timetable for his absence. A more difficult player to think about in redraft leagues is Jordan Lawler. He's going to miss 8 to 10 weeks following thumb surgery. He had a torn ligament in his thumb, suffered during a spring game. It's bad news because you're talking about half a season potentially that's lost, depending on how long it takes him to get through the final stages of the rehab. So we may not see him in Arizona until the second half. Needs on the roster will also determine, you know, when exactly he shows up as well. But if we're in a typical, you know, mixed league redraft situation with small benches or normal sized benches, I don't think you want to try and hold Lawler all the way back to his eventual return, even though I think once we do see him this year, he can be an impact player for us right off the jump.
Yeah, one weird thing that happened, though, was that he was sent to the minor league camp before Blaze Alexander. And Blaze Alexander is a 24-year-old shortstop that stuck with the major league team longer and had an excellent spring, just a really flat-out excellent. The batted ball stats we do have, you know, is like a 60% hard hit rate or something. Shout out to the reader that pointed this out. I immediately went and picked up Blaze Alexander, dropping Josh Palacios in one of my deeper keeper leagues, just because this opens a little bit of a window for Blaze, who is, you know, at 24, is got no reason to be in the minor leagues anymore and may just use this window of opportunity. That said, the projections for Blaze are pretty boring. It has a lot to do with his strikeout rate. He did more of an aggressive approach this spring, where he didn't walk much, but he also didn't strike out as much. In the past, he's been ultra passive and has struck out a lot. So if he did toggle that switch, and it's a good one for him, could be an interesting new Blaze. And for these next 8 to 10 weeks, he may be the backup for Perdomo.
Yeah, I think the results as he's moved through the minors have become a bit more interesting, a little bit like old for the level, but not way old for the level. 23 at AA and 22, 24 years old, of course, last year at AAA. It was only 73 games, but showed kind of double-digit home run power. This spring, he was among the players running a lot more, 5 for 6 as a base stealer, so really active on the base pass in addition to the adjusted approach at the plate. Probably an up-and-down guy, but for deep leagues especially, someone that could get more of an opportunity as a result of Lawler's injury.
2 months to showcase himself at the major league level, probably.
Yep, might garner some interest from other clubs if he's not part of the long-term plan in Arizona. An obligatory update that I saw scroll by, Wander Franco placed on administrative leave through June 1st, so I expect that to be extended at some point between now and then, and I think we've talked about it a few times. Just given the circumstances, I don't think we're going to see Wander Franco play ever again. Like, it's done. It's over. But that's what they did on opening day, placed them on administrative leave. Other odds and ends. Tell me if any of these things matter for deep leagues or otherwise. John Birdie is a Yankee now?
It's weird. Is that like cost saving for the Marlins? Because he was to the Marlins kind of what DJ LeMahieu was for the Yankees. And the Yankees were like, well, we lost DJ LeMahieu, so let's just pick up Birdie.
You know what I think it really was for the Marlins? I think it was wanting to keep some of the younger players around.
Like Brujan and
Jonah
Xavier.
Bride still on the depth chart. Like, they had a few infielders that they decided they wanted. And they traded for Nick Gordon a few weeks
back.
They
wanted to keep Gordon on the roster, yeah. It was probably the roster spot they wanted, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what it came down to. Birdie, AL-only leagues, really, really deep mixed leagues as a streamer, I think would be the primary use case. And LeMahieu being out does create an opportunity. You know, Oswaldo Cabrera can play a little bit of third base. Oswald Peraza is hurt right now, so I think that's part of why they wanted to go out and get another infielder that they could throw out there on a semi-regular basis.
The Yankees offseason is weird. You know, Jordan Montgomery's just sitting there the whole time. And then they're like, oh, DJ LeMahieu's hurt. John Birdie. Okay.
I mean, they added Juan Soto and Alex Verdugo and Trent Grisham, which gave them a completely rebuilt outfield. Like, that alone, I feel like, was a pretty good offseason. Plus, they added Stroman.
I gave him a bold prediction of a top five offense.
Yeah, I can see that. Three. Healthy Rizzo, Torres in his walk year, Verdugo in that park, add Soto, step forward from Volpe, Judge being Judge.
They also were fourth in barrel rate last year and, like, 25th in runs. That's not usual. That does not usually happen.
That is pretty surprising. I would say there is irrational pessimism around the Yankees right now. That's a good team that deserves to be viewed in a more optimistic light.
Red Sox, too. It's pretty amazing. I made a bold prediction about the Red Sox rotation being top five in the American League East. And that's not in the American League East, in the American League. And that's, American League East, that would not be a very a bold prediction. Although, it's a tough league. I mean, Red Sox fans are so down on that rotation that, like, I got accused of coming over this on drugs. And, like, there was a lot of pushback. But, I mean, there's just a lot of pitchers I like on that team. Tanner Houck with the cutter. You know, he's dominant against righties. Cutter Crawford now has a 20 IVB on his fastball, which makes him one of six pitchers in baseball that has 20 IVB, along with Nick Pivetta. And he has a 12-inch sweeper. So, like, I'd like Cutter. I've always liked Cutter. We've talked about Cutter on this pod before. Bayo's throwing the hard slider and stopped throwing that fastball. He had a 607 slugging against his four-seam fastball, and he stopped throwing it. So I think there's some good stuff coming in Boston that just got obscured by a lot of young pitchers trying to figure it out last year.
And we've got a few more bold predictions coming here in just a few minutes. I got a couple that I want to dig into from Eno's article. Nico Goodrum is a Ray, which is kind of interesting. It would have been more interesting 2 or 3 years ago. I think this is just the result of having a couple of injuries. Taylor Walls, of course, has been hurt for a while, but then Jonathan Aranda getting hurt late in the spring created a need for one more infielder.
You know, why not just say, okay, Junior, let's go. What is going on here? Is it just to keep Junior cheaper for longer? Like, what is happening? What does Nico Goodrum do? Like, they have, is Walls is hurt, I guess, huh?
Yes, he's hurt.
And Rosario, maybe they don't want to play him at short. They have not been playing him at short.
So another, I mean,
guess this is
Nico Goodrum
instead of Basabe?
I don't know. It's just one more name stacked onto a depth chart full of guys that we already sort of like for different reasons. You know, I've talked a lot about Richie Palacios. Curtis Mead is someone that can move around and play a few spots. So I don't see there's a lot of playing time for Goodrum. I'm kind of curious to see who eventually gets pushed off of the roster with his arrival, because it's going to cost someone something. I saw Austin Shenton made the opening day roster, so maybe it's a quick stint for him before he ends up at AAA.
There's some weird like games people play with roster deadlines and what happens like a week after. I think there's like a little bit of like inertia where like, oh, we decided who the roster is. We made our decisions. And so like for the next week or two, at least we're set, right? And then there are other teams that are like, ooh, people think that their rosters are set. And so if I can just do something for a couple of days, then maybe I can sneak someone through waivers later and keep them in my organization. And I'm looking straight at you, Farhan Zaidi, because the Giants kept three catchers. And none of them are really that good. I mean, okay, Patrick Bailey's probably a really good catcher in real life. You know, not necessarily offensively. They kept Tom Murphy and Joey Bart. Why? Because if they drop Joey Bart, if they put him on waivers before the season starts, somebody will just pick him up. Because you know the Rays would have. Didn't they just pull a trade for a catcher?
Ben Rortvedt.
Who, that was in the Birdie trade?
Yeah, I think that was a three-team trade, actually.
So they got a catcher. You know the Rays, if Joey Bart was on waivers, would have claimed him. And I think maybe now they say, well, we got Ben Rortvedt. Do we want to lose Ben Rortvedt to get Joey Bart? You know what I mean? So, like, I swear Farhan is just like, we'll have three catchers for, like, 3 days.
This is the way organizations try to function, because it's retaining as much talent as possible and playing within every last inch of the rules to get there, right? I thought the Brewers are going to try something similar with Eric Haas, but it looks like they're going to try
not doing the three catcher one.
No, he's not on the roster right now anyway.
That one was a little bit more interesting because Gary Sanchez has enough bat to be the DH. I am not playing Tom Murphy or Joey Bart at DH.
Right.
Or Patrick Bailey, for that matter.
Well, and I think because Bailey is such a great defender, you already have the elite glove guy. Sometimes that first backup is a all glove, we love how this guy handles the staff sort of player. If that guy's your starter, I don't know how you justify keeping the other two. It's just hoping you have a better chance of sneaking them through waivers later. That's what I think it comes back to.
Why do they sign Tom Murphy if they want to keep Joey Bart?
In case someone gets
Farhan's
hurt.
Farhan's been crazy about catchers. He traded Mauricio Dubon for Michael Papierski, who didn't end up being a catcher or wasn't a good enough hitter, and then he just released him 2 weeks later, and then he lost them, and he just lost Dubon for nothing, which maybe he was planning on doing anyway, but it was like he's been kind of furiously trying to like put catchers in his system. Cooper Hummel, he claims Blake Sable on the Rule 5 draft. He keeps Blake Sable on the roster all year long, which he was okay, I guess. And then he drops Blake Sable to the minors as soon as he can because he has now acquired this guy that's just in his organization because he Rule 5'd him. It's annoying.
It's just stockpiling as much as you can. Are you more annoyed by all of that, or are you more annoyed by Marco Luciano going to AAA?
I had a like fairly up and down conversation with Andrew Baggerly where we were arguing our positions and we didn't agree with each other. He didn't quite convince me. His stance was more like, yeah, Marco Luciano's not ready with the glove or the bat. He hasn't played a lot. He deserves like a whole full year in AAA to just play every day and play all the time and not face basically the, you know, the what happens in the major leagues. I guess I see that, but I see Marco Luciano's defense differently than other people, I guess. I see Marco Luciano as having nice hands. I think he has good hands. I think he throws the ball away sometimes, but I think, you know, it's a little bit like blocking with catchers. The guy misses it once and you're like, oh, that guy is terrible. Gary Sanchez can't catch, you know? And you look at all the numbers and you're like, oh, Gary Sanchez, not that terrible, you know? The same way with Luciano. I feel like he throws a ball away and you're, that guy can't be shortstop. It's like, well, he threw a ball away. I don't know. He has enough lateral quickness now to be a shortstop for the next 5 to 6 years, I think. And, I don't know. I would just stick him in there. I think we know what Nick Ahmed is. He had a good spring, I guess. I don't know.
I think the other improvements to the roster, like getting Matt Chapman, getting one more significant bat, was enough of a lift where you didn't have to force it with Luciano. And I think probably to the point that Andrew Baggerly made talking to you is Luciano, because of injuries, has missed a lot of time, but he also struck out well over 30% of the time at AAA and in the big leagues, 35% or higher at both stops, only 32 games. You want to make sure that's ironed out. He was hitting the ball on the ground a ton too, so wasn't getting to the power, was striking out way too much, and you do have some defensive concerns. Maybe you don't have them as much as others. Give him a couple of months at Sacramento. See if the K rate comes down. See if the defense is consistently where you want it, and then bring him up end of April, middle of May, whenever it's appropriate, based on what's going on with the big league club. You're not going to get much out of Nick Ahmed. As long as Nick Ahmed plays a good defensive shortstop, that's about as much as the Giants can ask him for.
There's a little bit of a change in organizational philosophy where the old Giants had picked up old players that weren't that great defensively and tried to coach it up. These new Giants have really improved their defense. And with Nick Ahmed and Matt Chapman on the left side, that's a big upgrade in defense over last year. So see how that kind of filters through for their pitchers and how that works if they have enough offense otherwise.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Two other random odds and ends before we move on to some other things. Miguel Sano made the Angels. He's starting on opening day. He's their DH today. How surprising is that?
I had the visions of that silly game I've got, which might be a fun offseason to play around with, is if you could take Miguel Sano and mush him together with Nolan Shanuel, you would have maybe a Frank Thomas.
Yeah.
But separately, I'm not interested in either of them.
So you're not getting the middle point of all their best skills. You're taking all of their best player attributes
and putting them together.
Putting them together. Yeah.
I was thinking, like, what about Esturi Ruiz plus Pete Alonso?
Sure. I mean, yeah, you can you can do all sorts of things if you're playing that game. Yeah. I actually ran into a situation where Shanuel looked kind of interesting to me. I'm in an OBP AL-only league. It's a keeper league.
Mm-hmm.
And the corner is pretty thin in general. And he actually had a decent spring, popped a couple of homers. We saw him get on base at a 402 clip last year, even though he was rushed, which is pretty impressive, right? So, you know, like, core skills for that particular league, mono league, sure, let it happen. He also stole a couple of bases. We talked about the Angels being an active team on the base pass. I don't know. There's just a handful of ways in deeper leagues where Nolan Chanuel might be a little more interesting. But the thing I want to watch with him is the quality of contact through the first few weeks of the season. Is there significant 100% improvement from all the standing? As you might remember, Sam Blum wrote the story about Nolan Chanuel standing all day long, 3 days a week throughout the offseason.
He must have gotten an Apple Watch. The difference between the Zips projection and the Bad X projection has got to be one of the bigger ones out there. The Bad X projects him for 7 homers, and Zips projects him for 18.
Yeah.
I love that.
That's a big difference.
I love that. I'm not going to go as far as to say that there's no Statcast in Zips. Like, I don't believe that. I know Damson Zaworski works on it. Statcast's been out for a while. There's no way there's none in there. But that just shows that there's a different weighting.
And the thing I would point back to, and this may have come up previously, is the scouting grades, right? Present game power, 30 over at Fangraphs. Future game power, 50. Raw 50. Power, 45. So it's in there as far as the scouting goes. So, you know, we have to buy into some of that. And if you have those other core skills to fall back on, you could do a lot worse in a super deep league. And
60% ground ball rate this spring. It's kind of amazing he hit 2 homers.
Yeah. Well, hey, if you do damage when you lift it, you can find a way to work around that. No, 60% ground ball rate. There's no way to really defend that. Last interesting note, it's Ronel Blanco getting a chance in the back of the rotation for the Astros while Justin Verlander's out. Verlander's absence probably isn't going to last that long. We're looking at a couple more weeks. He's trying to get stretched out to about 80, 85 pitches before he comes back. So just a couple of turns for Blanco. But I think we have to be somewhat intrigued anytime the Astros have anyone breaking into their rotation. They've shown us time and time again they can get a lot of mileage out of guys that maybe didn't have a lot of appeal as prospects. And Blanco's a little older than most of the guys that debut for them. He's 30. But I'm curious, is there anything in that pitch mix that intrigues you? There are some pretty good results from Blanco at AAA, given that he's been kind of an up and down guy for a couple of seasons now for this Astros team.
You know what's funny is you look at these walk rates and they're not good, but they are not like Edward Cabrerian. You know, they're sort of 10 to 11, you know, a little bit of 13 there, but and some 12s. But, you know, that's Edward Cabrera. We're talking about like 14, 15, and 16% walk rates, right? And yet they may have similar command. We've got 30 command put on him by Fangraphs, and then Location Plus last year said that he located his four-seam fastball with a 92 location plus. That is 30 command. And so I'm kind of amazed. They must be single. They must be using a single target with the catcher and finding, I don't know, miss patterns that work, or really working on game day ideas where, like, his slider location plus is 99. So maybe, you know, just enough sliders when he needs a strike. Whatever it is, 33% strikeout rate, 7% walk rate this spring. You have my attention, Ronel Blanco.
I just like to be playing deep enough leagues where anybody needs to be considered in those leagues, and there's always that possibility there's a little bit more in there. And I think Blanco is worth monitoring here in these first few turns. Let's get to some bold predictions. You wrote him up for The Athletic, theathletic.com/ratesandbarrels, if you don't have a subscription already. We got to start with a team one first. You have the Pirates finding their way into the postseason. Defend yourself, sir.
I went with a bullet point list, but there's a lot of stuff that I like about this team. It's just, you know, we've talked about Hayes lifting the ball finally. We've talked about O'Neal Cruz. O'Neal Cruz has like three of the top or four of the top 15 tracked batted ball X velocities this spring. So he is just really murdering the ball. I know he's got some strikeout rate and platoon issues. You know, some say he's not a great defender, but with Hayes next to him, I feel like that's a little bit mitigated. I didn't even put this on the list, but Jared Triolo is a big line drive guy. I think he's got like a 30% line drive rate in the minors, in AAA and in the big leagues. That's like, if he, you know, it's really hard to kind of keep your balls in the line drive rates, but it lines up with his good hit tool grades. Jack Suwinski struck out 20% of the time this spring. That's like the only thing he doesn't do well. Jared Jones was a top 10 spring plus plus string stuff plus guy, and he made the roster. I even like, but don't love, I'm not going to say this is like a big bullet point, but I like the idea of spending in the sort of $6 to $8 million range, you know, on the free agent market to get guys like Martin Perez and Marco Gonzalez and, you know, just even Eric Lauer, because they won't block your guys if they come up. If Quinn Priester is just exploding onto the scene, you're going to bring him up. Jared Jones, they didn't block Jared Jones, right? Jared Jones made the roster. So just getting to replacement level in some of those places, I think, is a big deal. I see a team that's better, you know, in a lot of ways. And what they are in is also in this interesting spot that, like, if you're a bad team, you try these guys as starters for as long as you can. So Luis Ortiz and Roynson Contreras. Those are guys that if you're a bad team, you're just like, they're our starters. They're going to be bad. We're going to be bad. It's fine. When you see a team that's in this sort of area, take those guys and put them in the bullpen, that means a couple things. It means they've got something else better coming. Paul Skeens, Jared Jones. But it also means, hey, we're trying to compete now, and Ronzi, you can't keep your fastball shape or velocity all season, so I can't put you in. You're in the bullpen, and maybe he will be a great reliever because maybe he can keep that velo up as a reliever. And Luis Ortiz, you can't command it enough, and you have excellent stuff. Maybe it'll work better in the bullpen. So, you know, they're doing the things, they have the things, and they're doing the things that, like, teams that are maturing do. And I just wanted to point out, last year, the Diamondbacks and the Rangers too, or at least the Diamondbacks were projected for the same amount of wins as the Pirates are projected for right now.
Yeah, the Orioles were the other team.
Orioles, that's it.
78 wins was their projection, and Pirates sitting there at 77. I think the interesting thing when you look at the NL Central is that the win total projection for the Cardinals, who Fangraphs has at 83.4, and the Pirates at 77.5, it's less than 6 wins, top to bottom.
And the error bars are bigger than that.
Right. In most of their divisions, there's a gap of 6 wins between first and second, because the Braves, the Phillies are a really good team, projected for, geez, it's like 13 fewer wins than the Braves. The Diamondbacks, a good team, projected for almost 10 fewer wins than the Dodgers. Like, that's pretty surprising, right? So that's how tight the NL Central is in particular. Even the AL Central is not clustered quite like that. It's, you know, 6 wins between the Twins and the Tigers. So you have the Twins, Guardians, and Tigers, more of a 3-team race. Maybe the Royals can get in there. They're about 9 games behind the Twins in the projection. And then the White Sox are in bad team land where they're just, it's just not happening. Like, we're grouping all the teams in the league and their probabilities of making the playoffs. The White Sox, the A's, the Nationals, and the Rockies would be the 4 teams clearly in the bottom tier, right?
Yeah, I'm taking the Pirates out of that. You
right,
know?
Pirates aren't part of that.
Pirates in,
they're in the long shot tier. Like, they're like
Reds,
a long
Royals,
shot that could make
Tigers,
it.
You know, right?
Yeah, that's fair. I think it's also going to hinge on what they do with the cluster of prospects they have that are likely all going to be at AA to start the year. Bubba Chandler, who had a late season promotion to Altoona last year, Anthony Sildameto, and Thomas Harrington, who actually has a rotator cuff strain, so he's going to be shut down for a few weeks. But some combination of those guys could make an impact later in the year as well, aside from, you know, Skeens and Jones and the names that we know are closer to contributing. So they do have a lot of interesting depth within that group of prospects that could round up a little bit on that pitching. And I do think the position player core is slightly overlooked. Brian Reynolds is one of the most underrated players in the league right now.
Oatmeal with honey.
Oatmeal with honey, right? just inside that top 100, so he couldn't be the captain of the oatmeal team, at least not this year. But you're right, you have a potential star in Cruz, the growth of Hayes. Like you can tell yourself a story. I think that's actually a fun, bold prediction that is bold enough, but is like kind of realistic when you start to break it down like that. So that's why I wanted to really dig into that one.
So one of these teams, if I could make a less bold prediction, it would be that one of the Reds, Pirates, Tigers, and Royals like makes the postseason. That's way less bold, but it's basically, I just picked the Pirates. I did a thing about the Royals too, where it's just like, these are the types of teams where things gel a little bit faster than you think.
I don't like to go negative on opening day, but who takes last in the NL Central if you have the Pirates getting a wild card? Don't even. Don't even do this to Barrel Man.
I'm not gonna say it.
Don't do it to Barrel Man, man. He deserves better.
I won't say it out loud, but I'm thinking it.
I'm so disappointed in you right now. Fine. Let's talk about something we both like. Let's talk about Sean Murphy.
Yeah.
The bold prediction that Sean Murphy will be the best catcher in baseball. I love this call. I love it. I think he's going to play more than he did last year. Like, you already have the core skills, both as a hitter and as a defensive catcher, to be the position leader in WAR. I think he's absolutely capable of that if the playing time jumps up closer to the upper echelon of catchers again.
Playing time is iffy because they have a really, really good backup. And that's what happened last year was, I think there were some injuries, and then people said the Georgia Heat, which I don't know, dude.
I think most baseball players who've spent their entire lives every summer out in the heat playing baseball are not bothered by the heat.
That's sort of my guess. But the injury one I get, and that could happen anytime. It happens to catchers. And so I think a lot of, in terms of like recency bias, or if you're a Braves fan, you might remember a lot of late last season when he was almost benched for TDA, right? Travis d'Arnaud was playing more than Sean Murphy was.
Yeah, but TDA had a 685 OPS last season. It was the second time in the last three seasons he's been under 700. And he's 35 with a ton of injuries, including multiple concussions on his resume. He's at the point in his career, you don't want to push him into the lineup any more than you have to. He's a 250 plate appearance player, if not a little less at this stage, on that team especially.
And then just the core skills for Sean Murphy are great. And I introduced a stat that Ben Clemens put together, which has some whimsy to it. It's whomps per whiff. Anybody who listens to Raisin Barrels knows about barrels. And he put barrels up against swinging strikes. It's smart. And it apparently is more predictive than WRC+, which is interesting because Sean Murphy still had a 129 WRC+ last year and was a 4-win player. So, you know, he was really good last year, and yet he was top 10 in this whomps per whiff thing. So, you know, you're talking about a guy who barreled it 16% of the time. We just said Will Smith was a really good player, and Sean Murphy does everything Will Smith does and in a lot of places better. You know, I think that Sean Murphy is sort of a ascendant. Well, another thing with last year is it was his first year with a new team. You know, this year I think he's going to be an unquestioned leader in that clubhouse and on that team, because the catcher is a normal place to look, and he is one of the most fastidious everyday planner types. Like he works really hard at the calling, the framing, all that bit, and yet is also just a really, really excellent hitter. So I could see all this coming together this year.
Okay, I like that call. There's one more I want to talk about. There's 10 in the article, but we'll cap it at 3 for the purposes of the show. Vlad Jr. is the AL MVP. And you wrote this, like, this wouldn't have been bold in the past, but I think it has become bold over time. I think the ceiling expectations for Vlad Jr. have come down a little bit. I think because he had two seasons since 2021 where he didn't play on that MVP level, people are now penciling him in as a very good hitter, but one that won't be in the running for an award like that. So why will 2024 be different? Because I think there's the version of Vlad Jr. that the projections will sell you based on his age and past performance. That is fantastic. And then there's just the more recent version of what we've seen, which is 26, 32 homers the last two seasons, 264, 274 average, you know, good counting stats, but not necessarily that superstar sort of level.
The projection thing was interesting. So I reached out to Derek Carty and said, you know, like, can you tell me what you projected him, how many homers you projected him for the last few years? And I was like, I'm not like Derek, I'm not going to, I love you. I love the bat. I'm not making fun of the bat. Like, I just, this is an interesting one because he keeps getting projected for more homers than he hits. Right. So in 2022, it projected him for 42 homers and he hit 32. And then it comes off of that and it projects him for 35 homers the next year and he hits 26. So like his projections are like, no, he's going to do this. And then what Vlad does is like, no, I'm not going to do it. So I think it is fair to kind of, I think that's what the market is doing. I mean, like to be honest, like if you look at NFC or ADP, you know, if you look at where he's being drafted and stuff, like he usually is a value where he's drafted according to projections. But I think the market is saying, yeah, you fooled me twice. You know, I'm not going to do this again. The one thing that under the hood that has actually changed is his launch angle. He has just slowly pushed his launch angle up over time. The best period for launching the ball in his career has been this spring plus the last two or three months of last season. That's a big part of it. I mean, we've been staring at Vlad Guerrero saying, yeah, you can hit the ball 118. Got it. Can you hit the ball in the air? And I see this happening a little bit from the home run derby. Remember, Soto hits the ball on the ground a lot. Soto hits like 70% of his pulled balls on the ground. And so he went to the home run derby. And this is, I'm wandering into narrative. I've wandered past the data. I'm into narrative. But Soto like went to the home run derby and started lifting it and had one of his better power half seasons after the home run derby that year. I could see something a little bit because I was watching Vlad in the home run derby and be like, you're telling me this guy can't launch the ball? I think he has the record for either number of homers in an entire derby or a number of homers in a round.
Either way, yeah. When you watch it, you know that there is a, and I realize it's like more like BP, of course, being in the home run derby. Right. But there is a ability to repeatedly launch the ball in the way you want him to. So how well does that translate to how he's pitched in games and how much of it is adjusting and not necessarily hitting pitches he can hit? That's been my open-ended question with Vlad for the last two seasons is he getting to pitches that, yes, he can hit and hit the opposite way for a single instead of possibly working the count a little bit more and getting into a situation where he's going to get something he's going to lift and drive? Like, is that the actual core problem, or is it attack angle and swing or a combination of both? Like, you could tweak even one of those things and get a better result.
You'll get both answers from different people. Like, if you talk to a hitting coach, they will talk about an attack angle probably for him. But, you know, if you just look at what he can do and if you look at what he did in that home run derby, he has a nitro zone up and in. That's where he can lift the ball best. And so it could be just a question of approach. Maybe just spit on more pitches that are low and in the zone and risk getting into two strike counts in order to get another mistake up and in. You know, I was looking at like improbable pitches for the craft with Nick. And, you know, I saw Devin Williams has thrown three high and tight super changeups, whatever that thing is, screwballs to righties. He threw three high and tight airbenders to righties last year. All of them were set up low and away. So if you're Vladdy facing, you know, you're basically waiting for mistakes that are up, you know? And I think he has such a good hit tool that he says, well, they're really trying to throw me down. They're really trying to throw me low and away and down because they know my nitro zone is up. Well, maybe risk a couple called strikes to get another chance at a ball that's up more than the pitcher wants. That's easier to change than it is to change his entire attack angle. Attack angle, to me, is a little bit like trying to change a pitcher's slot. It's going to take hard work. You've swung that way for a while, you know, and you've had success. You like nearly won an MVP that way, you know. So if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So maybe you could just kind of shave away at the approach and just be like, hey, just wait a little bit more for that pitch up.
Yeah, and we're still talking about a guy who's 25. He turned 25 12 days ago. So there could be three or four seasons that look a lot more like that first peak season in 2021. That's entirely possible for Vlad Jr. So that's a fun pick as well. And I think, as you wrote, the focus is on the Aaron Judge, Juan Soto, like the guys that have a little more year-to-year consistency. That's where most people's eyes are fixed when we're looking for possible MVP winners.
He's not a top five odds guy. And in fact, I looked at places where he wasn't a top 10 odds guy for American League MVP.
Yeah, so you want
my last year pick for AL MVP was Corey Seager, second place.
You were right by process.
Yeah, and if you read these, the process is often just because I want them to be educational in some way and informative and entertaining. The process is to try to highlight different stats, you know, and I just basically troll through different leaderboards and find interesting names and then make a bold prediction. You know, like Christopher Morel is top 50 in Seager. That's surprising. And he's also, you know, fifth best in max exit velocity among, you know, 25 and unders. Well, that's a pretty good combo. Let me just make him an all-star. You know, boom, bold prediction.
All he has to do is hit enough to stay in the lineup despite his defense or get better defensively somewhere. And then
there's
it's
a couple ways, easy way, right? Either he gets a little bit better defensively or he hits so much that they're just like,
it doesn't matter. We'll just let it happen.
Yeah.
But yeah, check out Eno's bold predictions piece up now at The Athletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
You know, let's talk about the biggest draft, like the one that your whole season kind of revolves around just because of what is at stake in it. You're in the NFBC main event this year. I am not playing in it. I'm not playing in the equivalent auction this year either. Simple reason, money is tight. That's the whole story for me.
And I have a co-manager partially because money is it's a tough one. It's like a $1,400 entry or something?
It's like $1,750, I think, is what the final number was. $1,500 for the big auction.
I didn't want to say it out loud.
I'm too much of a control freak for the auction, especially to share the auction. And I'm better at auctions than snakes. So anyway, those are my reasons. I'm in some smaller stuff, but nothing like that this year. But what I've noticed over the years, I've played in the NFBC main event for several years back in the RotoWire days. I usually had a co-manager to do it too then, and it certainly helps to have the extra set of eyes, given how important every decision is, making sure you don't miss on lineup changes, you know, going through the process, making sure you feel really good about the strategy, having that extra voice that you trust, especially if you get into a situation where there's a run on something, your plan starts to unravel, it's a little easier to untangle it with another sharp mind working with you. So highly recommend co-managers once you're into the high stakes world. Now, these drafts are different. The biggest thing up top that you'll see if you compare NFBC main event ADPs to the rest of the NFBC's events, and there's a lot of different league sizes and formats, you're going to see starting pitching early on get pushed up a lot. And this year in particular, we also saw relievers get jumped up a lot. And I think it's a little bit jarring if you haven't played in it before and you don't really expect it, because you're seeing names that are going a half round or a round or even more than that above their usual recent spots. So I'm just curious, like, as you've played in this for a couple of years now, how much do you tailor your strategy to knowing that's coming? Like, do you lean into it and say, it's okay, we're going to build a strategy around it? Or do you say, I think the group doing this might be as sharp as they are, leaving an advantage to playing it a little bit differently and not being as aggressive with pitching for this particular contest?
Yeah, we made a plan. Basically, it was close to a hard punt of starting pitchers, because we thought those starting pitchers had so much inflation and that there were so many questions after the top five. I think it's really, there's a top five starting pitchers, and then the questions start. I mean, I have Yamamoto in my top 10, and you're going to tell me there's no questions there? You know what I mean? Like, Tyler Glasnow is like, I think I have 10th or 11th. Like, the questions start quickly. And so, you know, we thought, let's do, so we made a plan together. It was to do one starting pitcher in the first 12 rounds. That was the plan. How's it go? Every plan is good till you get punched in the mouth.
Yeah, I think that's a Mike Tyson.
Yeah, so we actually, it was a little bit different. I don't know what the expression is, but George Kirby fell in our laps.
Yeah, I don't know if there's an expression for that. It's just a thing that happens.
We picked five in the first round. We didn't expect Kirby to be there coming back. So we were going to take Rafael Devers. And so we knew we had the choice between Betts and Julio Rodriguez. Julio was taken before us, so we took Betts. We took Betts over Carroll. Just felt like Betts was super, super safe and would allow us some positional flexibility now with short, second, and outfield. That might be fun and might be useful to us down in the draft later. And so we were expecting to take Devers on the way back. We took Kirby instead. And then there was the question, do we change what we're going to do and just have Kirby be our only pitch? Or do we take this unexpected boon and add to it, you know, take a strength and add to it? And what we ended up doing was taking Joe Ryan in the fourth to hopefully give us a good number two, and then sticking with the plan after that. So we got Betts and Semien along with Kirby, Hader, and Ryan the first five. That actually looks like a pretty milquetoast approach for the main event, don't you think?
Yeah.
Two hitters, two pitchers, and a closer.
It's a pretty common start, I think.
Yeah. It wasn't common. What we did next was not common. So this is what we did next.
That's the fun part. Like,
this is where we were like, this is what we're going to do that's different than everybody else. And nobody else did what we did. We took six straight bats, and we took eight of the next nine were bats. So we went William Contreras, Xander Bogaerts, Zach Gelof, Ke'Bryan Hayes, Cedric Mullins, Chaz McCormick, Aaron Civale, Rhys Hoskins, Tyler O'Neill. And what we did was we basically said, you know, we think the blob begins earlier than you do. You know, people are taking these Merrill Kellys and Shane Biebers and Carlos Rodones and Justin Steeles. And we're like, those are good pitchers, but we are creating a position player core that is across all of our positions. And we think we won't touch them all year. We want to get as many of those bats. We want to have a position player core of 10 position players we don't touch. And then we'll be working the wire hard around that 10 and fitting guys in. And we want to leave some openings. Because last year, we wanted to bid on Yainer Diaz, but we couldn't because we had two good catchers. So the way that we do this, we set this up so that we have basically one at every position that we're really strong about, and we're flexible when it comes to what comes down the pipe. Then, of course, when you do that, you create the need for the yellow brick road. And on NFC, pitchers are yellow. So I love this because so we did this thing, and I don't know if people notice in the room or they're just doing their own thing or whatever. Guess what our next picks were? Kenta Maeda, Louis Varland, Seth Lugo, Trevor Rogers, Shane Boz, Ty France, Tanner Houck, Reynaldo Lopez, Daniel Hudson, Trevor McGill, Edward Cabrera, and Brock Stewart. We just went yellow. And what we're trying to do there is we're trying to stay out of streamers. We think all of these players are players you want to have on your roster as options. You might put them on your bench or you might put them in your lineup, but you're not going to drop them totally. Daniel Hudson's, we just bought him for the one win. We just bought him for one win. He's going to be our dropper. That's all we did was Daniel Hudson, give us a win. Thank you. Bye. Because we could do that in retrospect. Daniel Hudson got a win in Seoul. In NFC, you get credit for that, which is kind of crazy. But we bought that win. We're 10th overall, by the way.
Hey.
Because we had Betts and Bogarts and Daniel Hudson. So we're going to win it, baby. But the idea was that all these pitchers are also all good options for week one. So for week one, we have 7 starters. And we have Brock Stewart and Josh Hader. Or Trevor McGill and Josh Hader. And we knew we had 7 good starts for week one. Week two, we'll see.
Well, Joe Ryan is particularly interesting because he fits into that cluster of the pitchers just go earlier in this particular event, right? You're talking about a guy that carried an ADP that was mostly around pick 90 for the first 5 months of draft season, had a little bit of a bump in the second half of March into the 80 range, and then went at pick 65 in the mains, like just a jump right there.
And that's exactly where we got him, 65.
Yeah, we saw it with closers. So I mentioned Evan Phillips was probably the biggest riser among closers, along with Andrés Muñoz. I think that was accelerated further by the injuries to Devin Williams, Joan Duran, Jordan Romano. All of that created this extra push that there was going to be a lift anyway, but instead of being 20 picks, it was a lot more than that, even compared to what we saw a month or so ago for those guys.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I'm proud of is that even if we had like a sort of milquetoast, could have been anybody's board top, we did something that nobody else did. And that allowed us, you know, when we were doing the Yellow Brick Road, we were like, oh, yeah, Louis Varland. Yeah. Seth, yeah. Trevor Raj. And we did a little of that yo-yo that I've been talking about, where you pair Louis Varland with Kenta Maeda. You pair Seth Lugo with Shane Boz. So we were kind of like pair floor with ceiling, floor, ceiling, floor, ceiling, floor, ceiling. And it was really fun in that moment. Aaron Civale was the one where I was like pounding the table a little bit. We cannot let Aaron Civale go past us, you know? Like him and Ryan Pepiot were right there. So Civale, Hoskins, O'Neill was a big influence from my side, where I was like, I want those 30 homers from Hoskins. You know, I want to take a shot at a healthy O'Neill. He's not that healthy now. And my co-manager was like, he's not healthy now. And I'm like, he's still in the lineup at DH, baby. That's different. He's not on the IL. When your sheet, in terms of the ADP risers, you'll see a real obvious, collection of guys that are just the closers all go up around because the closers are hurt. But there's some other interesting ones, like, you know, O'Neill Cruz jumped a whole round, you know, when the main started coming up. And I think that's just, you know, I think there's a little bit of the like, well, I'm not going to take Ellie. That's a bad deal. I'll take O'Neill later, you know. You know, Blake Snell went up a whole round. Just lack of uncertainty. You know, also the difference between Blake Snell signing in New York versus signing in San Francisco, I think is probably worth about a round. You know, Wyatt Langford went up almost 3 rounds because he made the team. You know, Dylan Cease went up. Do you think that Dylan Cease going from the White Sox to the Padres should have gone up a round and a half?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a good park and a better team. Yeah, higher win probability, and I just think a safer floor on the ratios, even though we know with the walks, you know, whip could be a little bit of a problem for Dylan Cease, but I agree with that kind of bump on him. And the guys that were dropping, right, you pitching coming up, which hitters come down? Old and boring, typically. Paul Goldschmidt was down like 20 picks in the mains compared to where he was going. I thought that was a pretty good opportunity for anybody that was looking at him. But then Kyle Schwarber was another big faller that I just can't get on board with, man. I just haven't been building teams with Schwarber in them.
He's just hard.
He's an over draft season player for me. I think I've built 12 teams this year and he's not on any of them.
It's one of those things where a projection system is just going to look at the value of the player and they're not going to look at how difficult they are to build around. Kyle Schwarber is a great punt batting average guy. You could almost decide to do the punt batting average because you know that opens up Kyle Schwarber for you. And it opens up a bunch of players, honestly. But I don't know. like, as much as one reason I'm proud of this main event for us is that we tried something that is basically punting. And I think that the nice thing about punting is it's so hard to be good at everything that punting allows you to gain advantages in other places. It's just so hard to do when you're in the room. Like, you've been wired to try and build a nice, well-rounded team. And then you're like, nope, I'm just going to build a team that has a 225 batting average. You're like, how am I going to win with this?
Well, yeah. The overall component, any contest with an overall prize, like completely committing to a punt is basically saying I'm
could I
probably
win
not
$200,000.
Like, you
if
could.
I had a 220 batting average, I mean,
but you have to crush everything else, and I think that puts a lot of pressure on everything else going right, that a lot of people are unwilling to take that risk. I think it's more of the which category am I going to be 50 or 60 percentile in, and then which ones are going to be my more dominant ones. And that's where steals or saves becomes the one that you might be a little lighter in. You say, well, I know I'm lighter in that category coming out of the draft. I'll take my shots in early season fab. If I don't find the category by a certain point in the season, then I'll just be content and not continue pushing resources at it, right? There's a few ways you can soft punt or just plan to be weaker in a category without giving it away.
That's the wording that I was looking for. I was going to say soft punt. And I think that the nice thing about soft punt is we had this during COVID, we had this competition. What was it called? The greatest team of all time or whatever?
Project GOAT.
Project GOAT, that's right. And the person that won it and the people that were nearest to the top, I forget who the pitcher was. It was some reliever that got like 12 or 15 wins along with like 25 saves. And it was not the most, it was like kind of an innocuous season. I mean, it wasn't one that you're like, oh, that's one for the ages. But all the winners had him. And the reason was that was their only closer. And in an overall, and so this is important for our current contest that we have. It's on the Discord, but you know, it's shut down now. But like, a lot of you guys joined it. I did a soft punt in a similar way for that one because we have, what do we have, like 1,200 people playing it?
Yeah, a lot of entries.
If you're up against 1,200 people, a full punt means you get a zero in that category. But a soft punt could mean 300. It could mean all those points of where all the people did a hard punt. So my soft punt strategy in that one was James MacArthur. I had one reliever. I spent $1 on relief. And I just want, if James MacArthur can get me 5 saves, heck, if he can get me 2, I'm going to jump above. If you can get me 2, I'm going to jump above a lot of people. So I think the soft punt is the way to go. You get off of the ground of the full punt. And so in this one, the soft punt was second catcher. Patrick Bailey is our second catcher. I got him in the third to last round. Our soft punt is starting pitching, really, honestly. Like, because we have those 2 at the top, and then we waited forever. And our soft punt is second reliever. Because we have Tyler Megill and Brock Stewart, and it's just like those were like waiver wire pickup type players, you know, it's like who you might have picked up in week 1. And the one of the reasons I like that one a lot is I feel good about Josh Hader, and then I feel like I can get another closer on the wire if you give me 6 months, you know, hopefully 2 months or something, you know, maybe even Megill or Stewart, you know? So like, I think you do need to find places where you're going to soft punt. And those were the places we identified. Also, I would say corner infield is a soft punt for us. Although Ty France, we've got him. JD Davis and Ty France are our, like, corner infield util. We feel like if somebody popped up on the wire this week, we could pick him up. You know what I mean? Like, it wouldn't matter. We'd fit him somewhere. Even if it's like Yiner Diaz and we want to keep Patrick Bailey, we could put him at util for a little bit and decide later.
Having that roster flexibility built in is super helpful because you don't know where the best pickups are going to come from. This is the best hitter. If I can't fit that hitter in, someone else is probably going to get them because I'm not going to bid enough, or I'm going to bid up and then I got to have someone who's too good on the bench. That's not a situation you want either. I did play an online championship where I had to think, like, okay, how do I build this team in a way that differentiates itself from the pool? I did it really early. I did the thing where I waited on pitching too, but I decided to go with Austin Riley and Rafael Devers in rounds 2 and 3. It was a combination that I didn't expect to draft.
But someone there is cursing your name. Somebody who wanted a good third baseman is cursing your name.
But I thought about it. I said, you know, of all the teams that are in this contest, like, who else put those two guys together? You very rarely take two corners in the first three picks and two with the same eligibility. I mean, that's pretty unusual.
Heath Law picked Riley for MVP.
The problem with MVPs on those teams, unless you do what Acuna just did, it's just like you get overshadowed by the other guys in that lineup. That's why it's so hard to pick a Braves player or a Dodgers player to win the MVP. That's the problem I have in trying to decide on who it's going to be. But Austin Riley, I've noticed all draft season, for as early as he goes and as good as he is, he doesn't get discussed all that much. But yeah, we'll dig into some more strategy-related things, of course, at various points. And the early part of the season, as we've said for a few weeks, a very difficult time to talk about baseball, only because you're looking at tiny sample sizes. So we'll talk about what matters in those samples next week, what actually moves the needle in these early days of the season. We have regular predictions, the non-bold variety, coming on Friday on the live stream with Trevor May, 1 o'clock Eastern on
change
our YouTube
ups,
page.
Change-ups.
And change-ups, which are fading a little bit. They're not as popular as they used to be, and they are fading. They're usually fading, literally. But I still love change-ups. A really good change-up, I still enjoy it.
So beautiful.
Yeah, so we got some nice clips lined up for the live stream on Friday. But that's going to do it for this episode of Rates and Barrels. Enjoy opening day. We're back with you Friday.
Thanks for listening.